our time. We uncaged.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and over the next 20 minutes, I'll be bringing you the quickest firing news roundup of the week. I'll be getting down and dirty with a very special guest going through some big stories. I'll be taking a part of this week's Question Time, and also I'll be bringing you some of the biggest, most banging political tunes going. So, lock and load, people. Let's go.
Uncaged.
Rabbit with a waistcoat and a watch.
Oh, my fairy whiskies! I'm late!
Now, this is curious. What could a rabbit possibly be late for? Please, sir!
I'm late for a very important date. No time to say hello, goodbye. I'm late.
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is Sunday the 10th of March, and that can only mean one thing. It's this week's edition of Topple Uncaged. I don't know about you lot, but yes, I feel a little bit like Alice in Wonderland this week.
What a peculiar place to have a party.
Because it has truly been the most bizarre 7 days in a very long time. Let's start with the Labour Party. First off, we have a Jewish councillor suspended on accusations of anti-Semitism. We then have the former mayor of Sunderland suspended by the Labour Party because he shared a post from George Galloway. And all this against the backdrop of the continuing furore over this subject. Then off to the Conservative Party, where we have the Department for Work and Pensions Secretary of State being openly racist about Diane Abbott. We have the Northern Ireland Secretary saying the most inflammatory comments about Catholic murders in living memory. And Theresa May's Brexit lurching from self-induced crisis to self-induced crisis. But, of course, if you believe the mainstream media narrative, the real catastrophe in this country is still Jeremy Corbyn's Communist Labour Party. Seriously, we have gone down the rabbit hole, we've smashed the looking glass at the bottom, and we've catapulted ourselves through the wardrobe straight into Narnia.
Whoa. Goodness. What if I should fall right through the centre of the...
So it's a bloody good job I'm going to give you a bit of a reality check on this week's Topple Uncaged. As always, I will have the UK's quickest news roundup. I've got an international journalist guest to discuss not only Venezuela, but the anti-Semitism crisis that's developing in both the UK and the US. I will be going in on the BBC's flagship tabloid political programming. Yes, Question Time. And I've got a legendary dance music singer joining me with his latest track. So, on that note, I'm late! I'm very, very late! Let's get going. The fastest news segment in the UK, it's Plucked News. Yes, it's the quickest news roundup in the UK. It is Plucked News. 5 news stories, 5 minutes, me giving you all the information you need, plus a little bit more at the end. So if you're ready, let's get going. And for story number one, I'm off to Disability News Service, and they reported that reaction to Rudd's reforms, tinkering crumbs and fears of a Trojan horse for cuts. This is, of course, the news that Work and Pensions Secretary Amber Rudd announced 9 reforms at the Department for Work and Pensions this week, the most eye-catching one being the attempts to roll ESA and PIP capability assessments into one from 2020. Now, as John Pring at DNS pointed out, this received broadly positive coverage from the servile, inept mainstream media. Whereas, dig a little deeper into the story, and it is a brewing catastrophe if this goes ahead. I'd like to say I'm not sure what planet Amber Rudd is living on if she thinks that rolling ESA and PIP assessments into one is going to do any good. Firstly, it's going to create even more stress for the claimant because they know that both their benefits will be hinging on this one assessment. Secondly, it involves outsourcing to more private companies. When has ever that gone well in the DW? But moreover, as several commentators pointed out, it could be an excuse to deny even more people benefits and cut the disability bill even further. There is this constant narrative of simplifying the benefit system. You cannot simplify a system when it is dealing with people with chronic impairments, illnesses and disabilities. Because by their very nature, they ain't simple. But really, this is a Conservative government, but we all know what this is about. This is about stripping back the welfare state, forcing more people into work who really shouldn't be in work, and ultimately the continued march in this crony capitalist dystopian system. Don't be fooled. These reforms are utterly toxic. And for story number two, I'm off to Drill or Drop, and they reported that breaking campaigners win court challenge over government support for fracking. Yes, this is a fantastic news that my mate Joe Corey and his campaign group Talk Fracking have won a legal challenge against the government's fracking, or rather shale gas if you must call it that, policy. Talk Fracking were arguing that the policy from the government was unlawful because it did not take into account new scientific evidence nor the climate change implications of widespread fracking across the UK. And the judge agreed, saying that the government's policy was unlawful because it had not even considered this misinformation. This is a watershed moment. Finally, a court has agreed that the government inaction over climate change in relation to fracking is actually breaking the law. Now, of course, the government will probably appeal this decision, so whether this results in any action from them or not remains to be seen. However, what it does show and what it is evidence of is the continuing fight against fracking seems to be winning somewhat. This, coupled with Quadrilla's earthquakes and the growing public dislike to the industry, may well eventually result in a change of policy at the government. However, this is the Tories we're talking about, so whether that happens in the near future or the far future remains to be seen. But this is a staggering win by Talk Fracking and Joe Corey, which could have not only national implications, but implications around the world. Fracking is a disaster for the climate, and now a judge has said the government has got to consider this. Well done, Talk Fracking. Now we're going across the pond for story number 3 and the fantastic Democracy Now! And they reported that inside the secretive US air war in Somalia, how many civilians have died as strikes escalate? The forgotten war against Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Yes, this continues to rumble on, but Democracy Now! Have brought it to the fore. Essentially, they reported that so far this year, over 250 civilians have been killed by US airstrikes, the US being there to, apparently, support the Somalian government in the fight against Al-Shabaab, who are affiliated with Al-Qaeda. So what Democracy Now! Firstly reveal is the fact that not all of these airstrikes have been reported by the US government. They don't actually know how many are being carried out. So therefore, we don't really know how many civilians are being killed. But the biggest implication in this story is the rolling agenda of what the US is doing in Africa. Essentially, the new president of Somalia, who was elected just after Trump in 2017, is a Somali-American. There is suspicion among Somalis on the ground that this is some sort of US-led intervention, which is looking to change Somalia and, of course, bring the US brand of democracy to it. What's also telling is these airstrikes have tripled under Trump. So, are we seeing elements of the shock doctrine, as Naomi Klein documented, basically bomb a country into submission so the US can put its own brand of corporate democracy upon it? Well, it's playing into a wider picture with Africa here at the minute. There's been the ongoing chaos in the Sudan, there's the US interference in Gabon and the Central African Republic. As I've said previously on the show, look to Africa as the new Middle East. It's essentially Western corporatist capitalists starting to export their brand of democracy, in other words, plunder the whole continent like we did in colonial times. And I think Somalia is going to unfold as the perfect example of this. Watch Africa this year. It is the final frontier for US corporatist administrations. The fourth story today is from The Guardian, and they reported that Shamima Begum, baby son, dies in Syrian refugee camp. Under the photo, they said, Begum with her son, Jarrah. His death will raise further questions about the conditions in Syria's refugee camps. This is, of course, the story of the poor little boy, Jarrah, who has died. There's been uproar about this on Twitter from both the left and the right. The right obviously saying that, well, this is correct. She should have never joined Islamic State in the first place. It's all her fault. The left saying, no, this is the government's fault. This is Sajid Javid with blood on his hands. I mean, essentially, it's very straightforward for me. This girl was groomed in the UK. She was our responsibility, and her son was a British citizen who has died on foreign soil as a direct result of these government actions. I don't know how many UN conventions Javid has broken in the case of Shamima Begum, but it must be a fair few. However, what's most frustrating with this story is the progressive left's response to it. I've seen so many commentators coming out saying that, oh, this is all due to Sajid Javid's grandstanding, his political career aspirations, and that's why he wouldn't let her back in the country. That is such bollocks, and it shows the lack of thought and the lack of knowledge of these issues that many of these left-wing commentators have. It was nothing to do with that. Javid's decision was partly to do with Trump's threat to release foreign-born ISIS prisoners from the US if the UK and Europe didn't take them back to their respective countries. But it's also setting a legal precedent because of the fact ISIS is nearly now disbanded and when there's going to be hundreds of British citizens who have fought for them coming back over here to the UK. He wanted to set the standard now for what we do with British-born ISIS fighters. But in doing so, it has led to the death of a young boy. This government is sick and twisted. And for story number 5, I'm back home to the Canary and my mate Freya Lockley, and she reported that a pathetic PMQ's response from Theresa May shows a dangerous ignorance about knife crime. Brilliant article by Freya, where she's juxtaposed the excellent Akala's interview on Channel 4 News this week, where he says the underlying causes of knife crime are related to quite often poverty, education, cuts to youth services. And Freya compared this to May's response, which she said will continue to enforce laws and also work on early intervention, ignoring the fact that they've cut youth service funding by hundreds of millions of pounds. Now, yes, don't get me wrong. While the issues surrounding knife crime are extremely complex, but as Akala pointed out, they are down to poverty, education, and lack of aspiration in young people, what Akala unfortunately missed, which I find rather sad, is why we have a cyclic nature to knife crime and gang violence. He says as much on Channel 4 News, but for me, he did not take it that step further. Now, the number of murders in London was actually highest under Tony Blair, as was the number of stabbings and hospitalizations from sharp instruments. And Akala recognized that these things do come in patterns. He said quite rightly that this has been going on for 150, 200 years. I would argue that it's been going on longer than that. We have to address, firstly, that there are peaks and troughs in knife crime, which is related to poverty and education, etc. But why are they always happening? Could it be the capitalist system we live under? Yes, of course it is. But moreover than that, why as a species do we feel the need to kill each other for material things? Or why do we murder each other out of jealousy and greed? Yes, that is because we have structured ourselves in societies which are essentially hierarchies, where a few well-off people at the top control what the rest of us do. That therefore leads to emotions that we are not naturally born with: greed, jealousy, and as the Bible pointed out, coveting thy neighbour's whatever it was. And this has been consistent throughout the human species since civilization's begun. Surely we need to be addressing and talking about the fact that we live in these hierarchies that ultimately cause these problems. The symptom is the knife crime, the illness is capitalism, but the ultimate disease is the way we structure ourselves as a species. And until we solve that issue, then history will just keep repeating itself. And I've just about got time to mention a shout out to my mates at Streets Kitchen. They have organised a demonstration at 10 Downing Street on the 15th of March at 6 p.m. Yes, this is their No More Deaths on Our Streets demonstration. Me and Nicola went to it last year. It was covered by Channel 4 News. So I really suggest you put that in your diaries. 15th of March, 6 p.m. Downing Street. No More Deaths on Our Streets. And I really have to fit in the sickening irony in relation to that last story, which is the Daily Mail reporting the millennial with a 1.5 million property empire. It just sums up the madness that is our capitalist system, where someone under the age of 30 can have all those houses and yet people are dying homeless on our streets. When are we going to realise that owning our own home is not the dream we think it is? And I definitely have to make sure I have time to fit in my shouts out for International Women's Day 2019. Yes, of course, first up is my gorgeous, wonderful girlfriend, Nicola Jeffrey. I'd also like to shout out to Paula Peters, fantastic campaigner with Disabled People Against Cuts. I need to give a big hello to Lisa McKenzie, fabulous working class academic and author of the fantastic life-changing book, Getting By. I want to give a shout out to my mate, DJ Casper, as well. You know who you are. She's a fantastic rapper and youth project worker. Also, Claire Stevenson, one of the linchpins of the anti-fracking movement in this country. Hi Claire, you're brilliant as well. Tina Rodwell, Ruth Lampard, Jennifer Breer, all forces to be reckoned with within the movement for myalgic encephalomyelitis, commonly known as ME, and the millions missing. Hello to you ladies. But moreover, I just want to give a shout out to every council estate working class woman out there who are always forgotten on this capitalist International Women's Day 2019. These are the real people who should be celebrated, the people who don't smash the glass ceilings and don't get to the top of their game. These are the people who toil day in, day out to keep our communities together in the face of rampant misogyny and classism. So, ladies, every single one of you out there, I salute the lot of you. And that is it for this week's Pluck News. My next guest is, well, where do I begin? Dissecting this week's top stories, it's me, free-flying with... My guest on this week's podcast is returning to Topple Uncaged. He is a groundbreaking journalist, one of the best, I think, of our generation. And he has recently come back from spending about 3 weeks on the ground in Venezuela. So we are going to be discussing that, the latest developments in the ongoing coup over there. But we are also going to be touching on another hot issue at the moment, which is, of course, the anti-Semitism crisis, not only in the Labour Party, but the unfolding situation in the Democrats in the US. I'm extremely honoured to have him back on again. It's such a privilege. I'm thrilled to welcome Max Blumenthal. Max, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. It's a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me back.
No. It's lovely. It's great to have you back again. It's brilliant insights last time when we discussed about Venezuela, which, of course, no one would expect any less from you. Let's kick off with Venezuela. I want to deal with the here and now first. So we're recording on Friday, the 8th of March. The latest sort of big story to come out of the situation there is this catastrophic power cut, which is affecting most of the country. There's talk of possible fatalities as we were going to record, because obviously the situation in hospitals, there was concerns over children who were on life support. Maduro's administration is blaming the far right, and some people are saying there could well be external forces at play, namely possibly the US government or some of its agents. I mean, what's your take on that? Is Maduro's administration right in what they're saying? Is it down to the far right?
You know, I'll wait to see if there's evidence. There have been a lot of blackouts in Venezuela over the years. In 2018, there was a blackout where 21 out of 27 states were left without electricity for a period. However, there have been a series of opposition-directed sabotage attacks on Venezuelan infrastructure last week. A warehouse where thousands of boxes of food, which are distributed at virtually free of cost to Venezuela's poor and working class, was torched, apparently by opposition elements, a week prior. Oil infrastructure, which is used to export oil, was attacked and basically blown up with explosives. And we remember last year that Nicolas Maduro came under attack himself during a military parade by drone. There was a massive blackout also right before the coup that deposed and killed Salvador Allende, the elected president of Chile. This is not something that's completely out of the question. And I could also tell you or report to you that yesterday I watched the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing chaired by Marco Rubio on Venezuela, where Rubio openly called for widespread unrest as a strategy to encourage regime change in Venezuela. So he openly called for widespread unrest. Then he took to Twitter to celebrate the electricity outage. But the widespread unrest that Rubio openly seeks to encourage isn't taking place right now as a result of this blackout.
The strategy, from what I read, the U.S. strategy moving forward with Venezuela is going to be a case of ramping up sanctions, if we believe what we read in the likes of the New York Times. That's their modus operandi with this. Do you think that is correct? Do you think that is going to be their way forward? And if you do think that's correct, do you think it will succeed?
Well, you know, watching the Senate hearing yesterday, where Rubio was really running the show, he invited all kinds, you know, these Venezuelan exiles to sit in the gallery. What you saw was a display of desperation. You know, Plan B, first of all, there was Plan A, enacted on January 22nd, where Guaido declares himself the president, this guy no one had ever heard of, and rides around on a motorcycle, you know. Looks like everything's going to work out, except the real government stays in place and their rallies actually outnumber those of a very fractured opposition, with Guaido representing a party, Popular Will, whose approval rating is 6%. Not a very popular party because they've been so involved in violence and destabilization over the years. Plan B was February 23rd, the attempt to ram through the U.S. humanitarian aid. I was in Venezuela for that. And I actually watched the coup collapse on that day. We subsequently learned that Guaido had assembled an army of 200 Venezuelan exiles to actually attack the Venezuelan police. And the Colombian military scuttled that plan and said, this is insane. We're not going to allow that to take place. So Guaido actually did want to take it to the next level. And so now we're at Plan C, which is just more sanctions. Sanction Maduro's dog and sanction the dog catcher. They have rescinded visas for 77 Venezuelan officials. Don't know who they are. I hope they're not UN officials, because that would be something that would seem to violate the spirit of the UN Charter. But, you know, the sanctions are deepening. It is moving towards a situation of starvation or attempted starvation. But the other element here is that the Venezuelan government is trying to find other sources of oil sales to receive its assets. And the longer that this government remains in power, the more likely it is, and the U.S. officials freely acknowledge it, the more likely it is that they will be able to start to recover some of their ability to export as they move away from the U.S. So I think it's going to take a while, and there will be economic pain as the sanctions increase.
That moves us on to our next subject. This is the ongoing... I'll use the corporate media terminology for it, ongoing anti-Semitism crisis within the Labour Party in the UK, and the sort of developing crisis with anti-Semitism within the progressive elements of the Democratic Party in the US. Now, for US listeners, the situation in the UK is that the Labour Party under leader Jeremy Corbyn has been engulfed, the corporate media would say, by an anti-Semitism crisis of epic proportions. proportions, where member after member after member of his party is being accused of anti-Semitic actions and words and posts on social media. It's all over the press. It's been all over the press for basically 2 years now, but it's peaks and troughs with it, as it were. In the US, of course, for UK listeners, we have a similar situation developing. Ilhan Omar made some extremely telling comments about the influence of Israeli money via organisations like AIPAC on US policy. Outrageous comments that she dared speak the truth. And she's been widely castigated, and the accusations of anti-Semitism are now following her. I'm going to cut straight to the chase here, Max, because, again, outside of the corporate press in the UK, it's what a lot of commentators are saying, and I know it's what people are saying in the US. Is this anti-Semitism being weaponized for political purposes, yes or no?
Well, I think people know how I'm going to respond to that question. But I guess just starting with Corbyn, I have an interesting story to relate. I don't know if
Go on.
You know it, but I've been, you know, sort of used to attack Jeremy Corbyn in the British tabloids and the Daily Mail. I was on my way to London from the Russell Tribunal, which was a sort of people's tribunal where we were discussing whether Israel had committed war crimes in the Gaza Strip in 2014, a war that I covered. I was in the Gaza Strip, so I presented testimony. And I was invited to speak about that in the parliament by a parliamentarian, a backbencher from Labour I'd never heard of before, named Jeremy Corbyn. And basically, if you wanted to bring a Palestine speaker, someone who, you know, was a credible speaker on Palestine, who was advancing the idea of equality and, you know, a decent life for Palestinians, which they have not enjoyed, Jeremy Corbyn was the guy who would give you permission. And he unfortunately wasn't able to be there, but his staff gave me a really nice tour of Westminster. We had a great event at Portcullis. I was late to the event, and so basically anyone who showed up to the event got to come up on stage for 5 minutes, and it was kind of like a people's forum. And this pro-Israel Likudnik fanatic named Richard Millett, who's been a big figure in manufacturing the anti-Semitism freakout in the UK, was in the back. And he found that among this crowd of people, this very diverse crowd of people, of Muslims and lots of Jewish people as well, like my friend Earl Oaken, who you might have heard of, who is a cabaret performer, who's also a proud Jewish anti-Zionist, all kinds of people spoke. And there was some figure I'd never heard of named James Thing or James Thring or something, and they said, you know, Richard Millett said he's a Holocaust denier. So the next thing you know, when Corbyn is, you know, nominated as the Labour leader, the Daily Mail turns up this piece. Jeremy Corbyn was introduced at an event by a Holocaust denier that also featured anti-Semite Max Blumenthal. You know, and the piece was written by a Gentile who'd never had a bar mitzvah or a bris. So I don't think they can really compete with my Judaism there. But, you know, that's the way it is in the UK. I actually looked at this James Thring character. He seems like really eccentric, holds some pretty outlandish views, but I really wasn't able to determine that he was a Holocaust denier. Maybe he is, but I didn't know who he was until I saw this whole episode, and nobody else did. They basically manufactured that story, and then they just freely characterized me as an anti-Semite. And I think that's the whole way the scandal has, this fake scandal has developed, to the point where you now have Chris Williamson getting suspended, someone who's a veteran anti-racist. Obviously, the target isn't just Jeremy Corbyn, it's the whole Palestine solidarity movement. And I can relate another story, because I spent a lot of time in the UK speaking about Palestine in my own work. And when I was in England, until I was able to escape across into Scotland, I was hounded by this group of fanatical Zionists who at one point actually physically, I don't want to say assault, but I was definitely physically coerced to try to not enter an event that I was doing at a Quaker meeting hall in Manchester by someone who tried to physically push me and not physically allow me into the event. And I had to demand that the police come. And this was something that led me to believe that Corbyn would eventually be assaulted. Now, there was someone, all the London events, who would constantly be outside and harass me and attack me on Twitter, named Mandy Blumenthal. And she eventually confronted me in order to ask what my Jewish ancestry was, because she was participating in a campaign, I believe, to claim that I wasn't actually halakhically Jewish. In other words, I wasn't Jewish because she was claiming my mother, who is Jewish, was actually Catholic, and so on. And we determined that we weren't related, fortunately. I was very happy to know that this woman wasn't in my family. But then I saw her at a forum where she was being interviewed about Jeremy Corbyn at some kind of town hall event, and she was claiming that she was a former longtime Labor supporter who could no longer support Labor now because of Corbyn. And this was just a gigantic lie by someone who had always opposed Labor, had always hated Corbyn, and it was deployed in the heart of British mainstream media. I remembered this woman from my tour, and I'm like, this is just a giant lie. So it's just like you examine all of these small incidents, and they make a mountain out of these incidents and these false allegations, and then they repeat it constantly until some section of the British public starts believing it. I think most of the British public actually resists it. But here's kind of how I feel about it and the danger of it. The danger of it is that, first of all, what the British press and the Blairite wing of the Labour Party are doing, and all of these defectors, it's like you're not allowed to say it, but they're all Labour friends of Israel allies, all of the Blairite defectors, what they're doing is they're conflating Israel with Judaism, because there's no doubt that Jeremy Corbyn is a critic of Israel because of its human rights record and the fact that it's implemented a project of apartheid since 1948. Jeremy Corbyn's against apartheid. But they're conflating Israel with Jews, and in doing so, they accept the same conflation that anti-Semites who seek to implicate all Jews for Israel's crimes do. And in that way, they're reinforcing an anti-Semitic perspective of Judaism, where Jews are necessarily supporters of Israel, and make it easier for Jews to be implicated for Israel's crimes. Another thing they've done is cheapen the accusation of anti-Semitism to the point where it has no meaning, which allows real anti-Semites who exist in UK society, in all across the West, it allows them to brand themselves as free speech martyrs when they are accused of anti-Semitism correctly, and to say, no, this is just another fabrication, just like the kind against Jeremy Corbyn and others. And so they are emboldening real anti-Semites. And finally, what they are doing is seeking to erase the painful cavalry that Palestinians have experienced since even before 1948. They've erased the Palestinians as a people and driven them not just further into occupation and apartheid. What they've done is they've driven them out of the debate and the narrative that everybody in the West needs to hear. Their voices have just been completely left out of this debate, and that's the point of it. That's the ultimate point of it.
Max, it was such a great pleasure to speak to you yet again. As always, brilliantly insightful. So transfixing to listen to. It was wonderful. Max Blumenthal, thank you ever so much for joining me on Topple Uncaged.
Thanks a lot, Steve, and thanks for the work everyone's doing at the Canary.
How good is Max Blumenthal? And you can catch our full interview on YouTube. Just search the hashtag Topple Uncaged Max Blumenthal. Yes, BBC Question Time. Yep. Nope, I'm still waiting. I'm still waiting this end. No. Anyone? No, exactly. Literally, BBC Question Time has descended into tabloid childishness. Where are all the adults in the production team and on the panel and, quite frankly, in the audience? So I've come to the decision I'm following Rachel Swindon and others' leads, and I am boycotting Question Time from now on. It has turned into an absolute disgrace. First we had the bullying of Diane Abbott, then we had the pile-on upon Barry Gardner, and this week I even felt a little bit of sympathy for little Lord Stockport and career commentariat Owen Jones.
Damn, Yeah,
but seriously, it's gone beyond the joke. It is bottom of the barrel Daily Star broadcasting now.
The earth keeps turning.
It's pathetic. It adds nothing to the political debate in this country. In fact, it demeans it.
The man that knows something knows that he knows nothing at all.
And it does little more than to polarise views and give viewers a skewed narrative from both left and right. So that's it. It's over. Question time. No more. There will be no more of it on Topple Uncaged.
Do not believe in God, but they fear us just the same. Oh, no.
However, if you have a suggestion with how you think I should fill these additional 3 to 4 minutes, then get in touch on Twitter. You can at me at Mr. Topple. Give me your ideas. What would you like to see me talk about for about 3 minutes? I could maybe do some debunking of headlines. I could do some top tweets from top Twitter people. Get in touch, let me know your thoughts, and I will pick the best one. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Bird Song. It may come as a bit of a surprise to regular listeners of Topple Uncaged, but I used to be a bit of a D&B head in my youth. You could often find me on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday night, bouncing around the nightclub, both physically and metabolically. However, this is a family show, so we won't discuss such matters now. So this week's guest is quite exciting for me. He is a bit of a legend, both known in his own right, but also sometimes anonymously as a singer on various jungle D&B and dance tracks. But now he has taken a turn to the political side of music, and he has launched a track with Cabinet of Millionaires all about our Prime Minister. So I'm very excited to introduce to the Topple Uncaged podcast Pat Fulgoni. Pat, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's a real treat to have you on.
Thank you very much. I'm blushing already. That's a lovely fanfare. Thank you.
So, Cabinet of Millionaires, you have released is what I'd call it EDM. I'd call it electronic dance music. You have released this track simply entitled Theresa, which is, of course, all about our Prime Minister. I mean, it's a brilliant track, and it's got some well exciting remixes, which we're going to talk about later. But first off, it's a heavily political track. And I mean, I want to use the Mrs. Merton, Caroline Ahern analogy here, the famous comedic character created by Caroline Ahern. Mrs. Merton, when she said to Debbie McGee, what first attracted you to the millionaire Paul Daniels? What first attracted you, Pat, to our bastard Prime Minister, Theresa May, that you felt you needed to write a track about her?
Well, she's quite hot, Rick. I'm sorry. Rewind. Good God. Hail Mary. Yeah, well, I mean, you've got to look at Theresa's track record, really. It speaks for itself. I mean, I'm just completely done in by the amount of homelessness and austerity, the threat to the NHS, and it's good to have a vocal out with the Cabinet of Millionaires to express that.
Indeed. I mean, there is, of course, a serious side to this track. That's what makes it extremely fascinating for me, because there's a big conscious movement of music, especially in the kind of roots reggae genres within hip-hop as well. There's some emerging artists in grime and drill who take on a bit of a sort of political, social slant. But dance music recently hasn't really been known for that. So did you feel that after sort of we're in 9 years now of conservative-led rule, did you think now the time was kind of right to you sort of drop something like this?
I mean, music just comes out, you know, the way it comes out, to be honest. I'm quite impressed by artists like Drill Minister, and I was pleased to have performed on the Love Music Hate Racism stage down at Whitehall. I think one of the issues could be the fact that, you know, dance music is meant to be uplifting, and I guess our Prime Minister's not the most uplifting topic, you could say.
True.
But we'll see how it works on the dance floor, you know?
No, that's it. And that's, I mean, that's what, again, is so fascinating and so good about it for me, because you've taken what is a bit of a banger of a tune, and then you've subtly, because it is subtle the way you've done it, you've subtly put an overtly political message in it. I think the way you've constructed the track as a whole with this slick EDM production, your kind of soaring vocals over the top, but then this sort of damning political message. No, I think it's brilliant. I think it's a very, very inspired move. However, what's most inspired is the remixes I've had the privilege of giving an advance listen to. Nice. Some of them. I mean, these are great. Okay, so you're overall, there's going to be four remixes in total. There's the kind of D&B remix, which has got that kind of feel to it, like I said, where I want to bounce around the room. There's a grime slash trap remix going on, which has got that sweeping bass line that both those genres are quite well known for. You've then got a dub remix, which is a kind of reggae, kind of dub infused mashup of it. And then you've got this funky house remix as well. It immediately put me in mind of, and don't take offense because I mean this. You don't know what I'm going to say yet.
There's not much of a plan here, so it's cool. I'll be using a lot of what you say for the next press release.
My writing services are currently free, so I'm more than happy to write one for you, Pat, if you like. No, because what you've done, it put me in mind of CNC Music Factory in the 90s, back in the day, who used to do massive remix packages for big artists like Mariah Carey. Always stood out for me, the way that they worked with her and reinvented the track completely. They took the original and did it in such a way that apart from the vocal and the lyrics, you wouldn't really know it was the original track. And that was the heyday of remixing for me. And since then, especially with mainstream artists, it's kind of petered out somewhat. No one really reworks as such their tracks anymore. However, this, I just love it because they're all reworkings. So it's just brilliant. Why did you choose to go back to that style of putting out completely different remixes of the track?
Well, I mean, it's appealing as a singer. I mean, it's always weird flitting between different BPMs. I mean, you're on a D&B track remix, you're in danger of sounding a bit Pinky and Perky, I guess, because you're like speeding it up or you're slowing it down. But that we get away with that on the Danny Styles remix because I mean, he's great. He's an original junglist, and yeah. I think it was Mo Love and L Double that turned me on to Danny Styles, who happens to be living up the road in Hull, so that's quite handy.
Okay.
I think with the Zion Train one was reasonably easy because I've sung for Zion Train in the past. I've been on one of their tunes on a past album and gigged with them a bit at some festivals, and I've worked a bit politically with them as well on the free education tip. So it was great to get Neil to do us a remix of that one. Really, really cool. I'm dead excited about that one.
Yeah, and that one does stand out. It is excellent.
And Indus Traps, I mean, they're a cracking band. I met Dirty Freud, as he's known, the wizard of Indus Traps, over at BBC Radio Leeds. He was doing a show there. And I got him over to Huddersfield to play a Love Music Hate Racism gig. He comes with an amazing singer, Lou, and they're such a great package live. And, you know, a couple of beers meant that we ended up agreeing a remix was possible with the Cabinet of Millionaires. So I was dead chuffed with that as well. So there's no real plan here. It's just beggars can't be choosers.
You're no newcomer to this. I mean, your sort of history with regards to doing music for political and social change goes back, and I don't want to reveal your age. This goes back decades, though, doesn't it? You've been doing this shit for years.
Well, I've just moved the Zimmer frame out the way of the of the cam there, so you can't.
Was that your nurse knocking at the door?
Yeah. The 90s thing was I was in a lot of bands whilst rotting on the dole after my polytechnic studies, and
that tells you how old he is, listeners. Polytechnic. Even I don't remember that.
I kind of spent a lot of time listening to music, and I ended up getting pulled into the Campaign for Free Education, which campaigned against the introduction of tuition fees, and that led to doing a track with Tony Benn, working a bit with him on the campaign.
Excellent.
And we had a double CD full of bands like Suede, Wedding Present, and we made a bit of a dent, got loads of press. It didn't change anything because the NUS, unfortunately, at that time seemed to be pro-tuition fees. That changed swiftly afterwards.
Just tell me, you told me in an email, and my Scottish listeners will love this fact, who was heading up the NUS then, Pat?
A chap called Jim Murphy.
Ah!
Ended up in charge of Scotland, yes, for the Labour Party. I'm sure I've got a letter somewhere where we were referred to as revolutionary extremists, which kind of made me quite proud at the time. In fact, it still does. And I mean, Chumbawamba got this letter as well, and you can imagine what they had to say about it.
Sure,
and
yes.
It was all over the media, you know, and helped market our CD. Job done.
Absolutely. I mean, and you've done a lot of work around, you were telling me off air, as it were, you've done a lot of work around where the BMP had a record label. Is that right?
Well, I mean, there was a record label called Great White Records many years ago. And unfortunately, I mean, Huddersfield's a fantastic place to live. It's very creative. But back in the day, probably about 15 years ago, there were three councillors from the BMP. And one of them was indeed a recording artist for Great White Records, which is a bit of a shame, really.
No, absolutely. But I think that kind of, that's an interesting point, really, and something which no one discusses much. The sort of idea of political music is one that's kind of imagined as if it's confined to the left, as it were. But it's obviously, it is used by the right as well. However, Cabinet of Millionaires and yourself are using music for the purpose it should be, which is to educate and to make people aware of what's going on. So the track Teresa is out now. You're dropping some remixes when?
On the 29th of March.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be on iTunes, and then I think the rest of the digital sites will follow shortly afterwards.
Excellent.
There is already a version out there, and there's a fantastic techno mix from Steve Whitfield,
okay,
who once produced The Cure.
Oh, blimey.
And he's a good collaborator on some of my gear as well, so big up Steve for that one. I'll send you that one if you've not got it.
I haven't. I'd love to hear it. A techno. Now, if you can do a happy hardcore one for me, that would make my day, because happy hardcore used to be really, really my thing. I was well into happy hardcore back in the day. But again, that's not really a conversation for a family fucking show.
No.
So we'll park that one as well. Pat, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And like I say, I mean, the track is just brilliant. And the remixes are the bomb. They're just absolutely
made up
brilliant.
You like it, man. Thank you so much.
No, I do. Seriously, it's brilliant. I love it. It's great. It's going to slot nicely in my growing collection of kind of roots, grime, and hip-hop. A nice bit of EDM with four different remixes. Perfect. Pat, thank you so much for coming on Top Run Caged.
Thank you.
How cool is Pat Fulgoni? Check him out, and check this out as well. This is such a banger. It is a massive track which hopefully is going to blow up in clubs up and down the country. It is Cabinet of Millionaires and Teresa. Cabinet of Millionaires and Teresa. Check it out. Teresa, baby. And that's it. Episode 17 of Top Line Caged is done. I would like to thank my fantastic guest this week, the incredible Max Blumenthal. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Max Blumenthal. And Pat from Cabinet of Millionaires. Follow them on Twitter. It's at Cabinet Millions. As always, behind the scenes, thank you to the love of my life, the gorgeous Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. My man in the booth, sound engineer Gaff Paws. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Paws with a Z Radio. And as always, thank you to my in-house singer. It's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray underscore star 113. Thank you to the Canary for uncaging me. I'm off to have myself a Mad Hatter's tea party. I will see you next week.
Uncaged.